So this report is our annual flagship report, and it really looks at all the global trends for refugees and asylum seekers and other people who are of concern to UNHCR. And it is pretty alarming. I mean, it basically says that 108 million people have now been forcibly displaced at the end of December last year. But that number has significantly increased between December and June. So now we are close to about 110 million people who are forcibly displaced. So that's like one in every 74 people on this planet. And even more disturbingly, 41% of that are children. And that's really horrific when you think that only 30% of the global population is actually juvenile.
The figures also show that most refugees, they end up in, you know, low-income countries and middle-income countries. So why is that, and what impact does that have in those low to middle income countries?
I'm glad you asked that question, because one of the really popular myths that you see in a lot of Western media is that everybody, all the refugees and asylum seekers, are taking to boats or undertaking these dangerous journeys to get to the West. And that's totally untrue. So what is really happening is that 70% of the world's refugees are actually just going to neighboring countries. They're literally just crossing the border and going to the country next door. And 76% of the world's refugee population is actually hosted, as you said, by middle-income and low-income countries. In fact, the low-income countries are actually hosting 22% of the world's refugee population. So that's about 46 countries, which are really serious domestic challenges themselves, who are also hosting these millions of refugees.
What are some of the examples of the support that those countries need, and what is UNHCR doing to help those countries find some solutions?
So what we're actually doing is, and I'm sure you know this, but just it does bear repeating that all our programs are funded by voluntary contributions from governments and states. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we are levying an assessed contribution from governments or from private sector people. If they want to give, they give us money. So we are only as good as the money we get. But primarily what we do in refugee hosting countries is try to assist these people, or rather support the governments in hosting them. So ensuring that these refugees have access to basic services, whether it's a roof over their head, food on the table, that their kids can go to school, that the refugees, the adult refugees, have some kind of form of access to, you know, when sort of gainful employment. But it's an uphill task, because as we just said, most of these refugees are hosted in middle income and low income countries, which already economically are challenged. So we actually did this report last year on underfunded emergencies or underfunded refugee situations. And what we are finding is that refugees who were self-reliant before have now had their situations deteriorate quite dramatically. So we see women being forced into early marriages, survivors of gender-based violence, children being taken out of school because they just don't have the money to keep them there.
You said something that was extremely striking, which is we're as good as our money is, right, in terms of being able to access those resources. My next question to you is, what is it that, you know, wealthier countries can do to support those countries?
First of all, perhaps the most compelling illustration of what Western countries can do, or in fact what the entire global community can do, was actually included in this Global Compact on Refugees that was endorsed by the General Assembly in 2018. And that basically sets out what is actually needed to address refugee situations, whether it's the donor countries, whether it's refugee hosting countries, or whether it's the refugees themselves. So it's all about refugees, providing refugees with the opportunity to become self-reliant, Western country or the donors helping refugee hosting countries to share that responsibility of hosting these refugees by providing money, by providing in-kind support, and then also providing solutions in the form of third country solutions, if you like resettlement programs. And we are lucky because this year we had some 114,000 refugees who actually resettled. So that's, this was in 2022, that's double the number of 2021, and that's almost going back to pre-pandemic levels. So that's already positive. And then, of course, the key thing is to find solutions for all the refugees. And again, resettlement is just one. It's less than 1% of the global refugee population that has access to that solution. The other solutions, of course, voluntary repatriation. So for refugees to be able to go back to their countries of origin, we had over 344,000 maybe last year who managed to go back. despite really adverse conditions. So we had refugees going back to Cameroon, to Cote d'Ivoire, even to Syria and Afghanistan. So that was positive. And even more strikingly, we had over 5 million internally displaced people, people who were compelled to leave their homes but remained inside the country, who were able to go back to their country, to their homes. So that's, in this incredibly bleak landscape, at least there were some few pockets of hope. So.
Right. Yeah, the silver linings are definitely Absolutely. There. I understand that the report is an in-depth, multi-layered snapshot of 2022, right? But we can't quite ignore this, you know, the military power struggle in Sudan, and that's, you know, causing all sorts of multi-layered crisis. What would you say that are some of the biggest challenges for, you know, Sudanese refugees right now?
One of the things that we keep emphasizing is that there are some 450,000 Sudanese now who have already left Sudan and gone to neighboring countries as refugees. And they're all going to countries in the region that are either emerging from crises themselves or are still in the throes of crises. So, for example, Chad, South Sudan, or Egypt, all of these countries basically can ill afford to have huge numbers of Sudanese refugees crossing in. But they have been amazing because they've all kept their borders open. And they are allowing these people to come in to seek asylum there. But the most urgent needs are basically food, shelter. And in Chad, for example, 91% of the Sudanese refugees coming in are women and children. And we are finding, for example, survivors of gender-based violence. So these women do need programs that address their situation as soon as possible. And that's what we are doing. So we are in all of these countries supporting the governments basically to assist these people and to provide them with protection.
Extreme weather is really forcing people to leave their homes. How does that affect, how has that been affecting refugees?
I think about 80% of the world's refugee population are actually coming from climatically vulnerable countries. And many of them are actually hosted in climatically vulnerable countries as well. Just take a look at the Sahel, for example. You know, people crossing from Burkina Faso, Mali, and going to neighboring countries, which are actually facing the same climate challenges as the countries they've just left. So we are kind of changing our strategy a little bit. I mean, beyond the traditional refugee assistance programs that we do, which is provide shelter, food, and health services and support the governments in doing that, we are also advising governments in these countries to sort of undertake adaptation and mitigation efforts. So, for example, we know, for example, in Bangladesh, cyclones and floods are cyclical. We know that practically as, you know, night follows day, that at some point during the course of the 12 months, Bangladesh is going to be undergoing a severe weather crisis. So what we're doing is advising and supporting the government in enforcing not just the refugee settlements themselves, but also the host communities to make sure that they have proper measures in hand to stop these cyclones from, you know, resulting in casualties and in really egregious damage. And that actually did succeed with the recent flooding in Bangladesh with the Hurricane Mocha, basically. Yeah. It did result in considerable material damage, but at least there were no casualties as in previous years. So we're deeply grateful for that. And then in contrast, in the country next door, in Myanmar, where there were no such mitigation measures, there were a higher number of casualties and much more material losses as well.